introduce Eileen T. from Sun City as our first speaker. Let's give her a warm welcome.
Hey. Nakona. So exciting. My name's Eileen. I'm an addict. And I know a few faces in the room, but not too many, which is good, because I always think people have heard my story over and over and over again. They're going to get sick of hearing me. You know, this is an exciting convention, the first Northern Arizona convention. I got to go to the first Southern Arizona convention probably 5 or 6 years ago now. And, you know, I've been going to our regional convention for many, many years now. And what I know for me is that conventions are one of my fill me up weekends. I need conventions. I need hugs, but I'm not giving any. I have 13 grandkids. Is Angie in here? She shared last night about having 13 grandkids, and I have 13 grandkids, but I have two more in the oven, so I'm going to beat her right now. Conventions and the annual women's retreat that my home group puts on every year are like my spiritual fill me ups. My whole recovery, I have been totally dedicated to taking care of myself and taking time out for myself and leaving the outside world behind just for a weekend and remembering why I'm here and where I came from. So, my clean date is May 29th, 1991, so I have 29 years, and if everything goes the way I want it to, if ARCNA happens this year, I'll be celebrating 30 years clean Saturday night at the convention, if we have a convention. So I will be decked out in a tiara and a sash and lots of sparkle. You will know who I am. It'll be my 30th birthday if everything goes the way I think it's going to go. So I'm looking forward. Hopefully we'll have an ARCNA this year. Next year. I'm not really sure how that's going to go. But I'll just tell you a little bit about where I came from. I grew up on the East Coast in a small little town that was 1 mile square. And I'm the youngest of five kids. I have two biological siblings and two adopted sisters from Korea. And just to tell you a little bit about addiction in my family, my dad died of alcoholism. My biological sister is an alcoholic. My biological brother is an alcoholic. I'm an addict, and my two adopted sisters are normal. So take from that whatever you want. We all grew up in the same household. My personal belief is that I'm genetically predisposed to this disease, and it didn't matter kind of what household I was going to be brought up in. It's just going to be my lot in life, that I was just going to walk that road like my dad walked that road and my siblings had walked that road before me. The difference is that I broke the cycle in my family. And I was able to use the word addiction with my family. When you know, I grew up in this big Irish Catholic neighborhood, and nobody talked about addiction back then. There were no treatment centers. Nobody knew what to do with me. I was out of control at 13, 14 years old. I was running with, you know, 25-year-olds and hanging out down at the park is where all the bad kids hung out, you know, and I was a staple down at the park. And, you know, I hung out with all men. They weren't just guys. They were grown men, you know. And I was a little teenage girl trying to be a badass. And I don't know what happened to me. And it doesn't really even matter. I tried for many years to figure out how I ended up the way I ended up. And why did I put a needle in my arm and nobody else put a needle in their arm in my family? But the truth of the matter is none of that matters. What matters is that I was forced into Narcotics Anonymous. I'll tell you that part of the story in a minute. But all that matters is that I got here and there were people here before me that knew the right things to say in the meetings I was going to. Things like, keep coming back and will love you until you can learn to love yourself. And let me show you how to work a first step. No, you haven't done it already. So what happened for me was that, you know, I used lots of drugs like all of us did. I rationalized and justified and tried, you know, not using before noon and only using on the weekends and only using this drug or that drug or the liquid drug. And none of that worked for me. I just used and used and used, and I don't even know what I was trying to suppress, because I was never abused as a child, which is one of the other reasons I felt like I didn't really belong here, because everybody has abuse in their story, you know, except for me. So I thought, wow, there's really something fucked up in, about me that I not, that never even happened to me, and look how I turned out. So, you know, I used lots of drugs, and I was a lost person. I was just completely lost, and my parents didn't know what to do with me. So when I was about 17, they offered me a one-way ticket to Las Vegas, where my sister lived with her husband, who was in the Air Force. And I was going nowhere fast. I was kind of skating out of trouble and manipulating my way out of trouble. I'd been arrested a couple times as a juvenile, but like released to my parents, who I didn't even live with. I live with a drug dealer, you know. And so, of course, I raised my hand. I said, Vegas, hell yeah, you know. So I went to Vegas. I was 17. I was getting into casinos and manipulating that. And then my sister told me I couldn't live there anymore. I was there about 6 months and using like a crazy person, you know. And she told me I couldn't live there anymore. So I really had nowhere to go. My parents said, you know, said no. And my sister now said no. And so I thought maybe the military was going to be my answer to fixing my problem. You know, I needed structure and discipline is what I thought. So I joined the Air Force, and for the next 8 years, I used the liquid drug exclusively because they test for all the other drugs in the military. And that did just as good a job as shooting heroin did to suppress my feelings and to make me feel happy and to feel like a badass, cool chick, biker, bar, hanging, whatever you want to call me. I didn't know, I can't say I never heard of recovery. When I was about 15, somehow I ended up in an NA meeting in this little town that I was in, and I remember going in there and feeling everybody was older, and I felt so awkward, and I asked a guy, I went to a couple meetings, and I remember asking a guy to be my sponsor, and he said, no, it doesn't work that way, and I was like, okay, fuck you, I'm not coming back, so I didn't go back, you know. I wasn't ready to get clean anyway, but... So what ended up happening for me was, you know, I got married, I had a kid, my life was going on, and I was a mess. I was just a mess. I got divorced, and I started going to college. I thought, well, I need to be able to figure out a way to support myself and my daughter, right? So I'm living in, at this point, in Southern California, first college I ever went to, Compton Community College, believe it or not. I lived in the town right next to Compton. And I started taking prereqs. I decided the military, I was getting out of the military. Desert Storm was happening. I had a kid to support. I need to figure out what I'm going to, all the aircraft companies were laying off, so I wasn't going to bridge to the aircraft maintenance world on the, in the outside world. So my mom was a nurse, and my sister was a nurse, and I thought, well, you know, I'll just start going down that road, right? So it took me a long time because I was using addict. It took me 5 years to get an associate's degree because I failed classes and I quit and I restarted. And somehow, I don't know how that happened, but I got through nursing school. And I don't know how that happened. I would, you know, go to class. I would, you know, I always had some man supporting me, so I didn't really have to work at that point in my life. I'd go to class. I'd get out of class. I'd go to the bar. I'd get hammered, I'd drive drunk, pick my kid up from daycare, go home, like drink till I passed out, and then wake up the next day and do it all over again. And somehow I retained enough information to pass nursing boards. I don't really know how that happened, but I got my first job in a very large hospital in Southern California. And, you know, I was thrilled. I was always making, you know, besides the military, I was making minimum wage. I had no education. I was a high school dropout. And so I got my first job, and, you know, I'm an untreated addict, right? So what happens to an untreated addict that has narcotics in front of them every single day of their work life, right? So within 3 months of getting my nursing license, I diverted my first narcotic from a patient. And within 7 months of getting, so a four-month period from my first diversion to my last diversion, I started with one pill, and at the 4 months after that, I was diverting every narcotic for every patient every 4 hours, and pregnant, and getting loaded in the bathroom, and I didn't kill anybody, thank God. I made mistakes, and I remember pulling a tube out of this guy's kidney once. That was not a good day. But I always wiggled my way out of trouble, always. And what ended up happening was somebody, back then, they didn't have these fancy computer things where you put your numbers in and the narcotics pop out of a drawer. Back then, it was a locked cabinet, and they had these big books with duplicate paper on it. And you'd have to write the patient's name, the medication you're taking, how many, what the count was when you started, and what the count was after you took your narcotics out. So I wrote this guy's name down, and I wrote two, but I took out like 10. Somebody saw me take the roll of narcotics and go like this and count and rip it and stuff it in my pocket. Somebody saw me do that, so they turned me into my supervisor, and you know, she was she was trying to be nice. She called me into her office and confronted me, and I lied because I always lied. I was a habitual liar. I told her, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not a drug addict, you know. And so she sent me home. She gave my patients to somebody else. And the next day, I went back to work, and she fired me. She gave me another opportunity to tell the truth, which I did not do. And so she fired me. So I went home, and I think I got loaded for a couple more days. And then I called the Board of Nursing because I wanted to know what was going to happen to me, because my history was, if I could just wiggle my way, if I had enough forewarning, I could figure out a way to get out of trouble. Like, I can wiggle my way out of this somehow. So I called the California Board of Nursing thinking, if I know what my options were, I can get out of this somehow. So I called, and I got this guy on the phone. And he asked me if I was loaded, and I was anonymous with him on the phone. He didn't know my name. And he asked me if I was loaded, and I told him I was. And he asked me to call him, to hang up, don't get high the next day, and call him the next day. So I called him the next day, and he asked me if I did it. And the first truth came out of my mouth in a long, long time. I said yes. And it wasn't really because I was ready to get clean or wanted to come clean. It was because I wanted to know what was going to happen to me so I could wiggle my way out of trouble. So he told me I had two options. I could get a lawyer, and I could try to fight the charges. And there were many, many felonies. Every one pill they proved I took was a felony, every single one. And there were a lot. Or I could go into this little program they had for nurses. So me, like, I look tough, but I'm not tough at all. Right? So I'm not going to jail, because I knew if I went down the lawyer route, I was going to jail for a long time. Never been to jail. Don't want to go to jail. Could probably do okay back then. Now, forget it. So anyway, I went into this program for nurses, and they make you sign a contract that's an inch thick that says, you know, you can't work night shift, you can't be in charge, you can't give narcotics, you can't carry keys, you can't. Oh, and when you go to look for a job, you have to tell them that you're an addict in recovery, and see if they're going to hire you anyway. So, you know, by this time I was married again. I had two kids. My son was 3 months old when I got clean, and my daughter was five. And I had a husband back then who didn't love to work a lot. So I was the primary breadwinner for our family, you know, and I was a nurse. You know, in those 7 months, I was making pretty decent money. Our standard of living went up quite a bit from that little town next to Compton to a couple towns away, you know. And, you know, they had all these requirements that I had to do, and I was just jumping through the hoops to keep my license. That was the only reason I went to an NA meeting, was to keep my nursing license. That was one of the requirements. I had to go to three 12-step meetings a week. I had to go to a nurse support group once a week. I had to go to a counselor, which was ridiculous because she was an idiot. She had a lot of letters after her name, but she didn't know anything about addiction. and I had to pee in a bottle whenever they told me to. So I did that, and it was a 3 to 5 year program, and if I did everything they said, I could keep my nursing license and they would erase everything. Nobody would ever know that I was a drug addict, that I had stolen drugs from my patients. So I signed up for that one. And I started going to meetings. And, you know, I remember my first meeting was a little place called the Rap Center in Long Beach, California. And it was smoky and gross and nasty couches. And I walked in the back and I was highly embarrassed because, you know, I'm a college graduate, professional, and here's all these people that, you know, when I think of a drug addict, I think of, you know, a homeless person, really. And I still wasn't thinking of myself as a drug addict. I just thought, well, I got to stay away from, you know, those drugs. And I'll just party on the weekends. That was my plan, like to get through this 3 to 5 year program, and then I'll just stick to the weekends. I'll stick to the liquid drug. That one's legal. And we'll be good. So I started going to meetings, and another requirement in my contract was to get a sponsor. And I didn't know what a sponsor was, really. And they told me it had to be a female. I was like, oh, great. I hate females. And she had to have more than three or four years clean, I think. And so I was at a meeting shortly after I got clean, and there was this girl celebrating 4 years. And I walked up to her after, you know, and will you be my sponsor? And she said, well, why don't you call me? I was like, bitch, why don't you call me? She's still clean today, by the way. So I got a sponsor, and then, you know, the miracle happened as soon as I started working steps. You know, if you're new and you don't understand the language, you don't know what's going on, I remember just being so confused and what the hell's going on here. I remember reading the steps on the wall, on the big poster they had, you know, like, how the fuck is that going to help me get out of trouble? Like, stay out of trouble and change? Like, no way is that going to do it for me. So I remember saying to my first sponsor, I've already done 1, 2, and 3. And she's the one that said, no. In Narcotics Anonymous, we write our steps. And then we go over them one by one with a sponsor. And I will tell you when you're ready to start your steps. And I will tell you, and this is how she still is. She's a badass with 33 years clean. I will tell you how it's going to go. And I was like, bitch, okay, because I wanted to keep my nursing license, right? And I had to have a sponsor, not because I was ready to change or thought I was a drug addict or anything. So, you know, then, you know, weeks turned into months, and my life just completely changed from insecure, low, no self-esteem, afraid of everything, looking for men to fix all my problems, to, you know, I became a mother in Narcotics Anonymous. People in NA taught me how to be a mom. You know, I didn't know how to be a mom. My mom was mentally ill, and I didn't learn a lot of decent parenting skills from her, and my dad was drunk all the time, so I really had no frame of reference. So the women in the rooms taught me how to be a parent. You know, I was a spanker. And my kids would cower like that. I remember those days when I would raise my hand and my 5-year-old, 6-year-old daughter would just cower, and people in the room said, you can't keep doing that. That's not okay. They call that child abuse nowadays, you know. Back in the day, it was discipline. You know, I got disciplined. So I started raising my kids, and I was going to meetings, and I have a sponsor, and I'm working steps, and my whole inside of my being started to change. Like, I was like not looking at the floor anymore. I was able to look people in the eye and not feel horrible about myself or embarrassed about all those horrible things I had done. My first job clean was driving a truck for a Volkswagen dealer in Southern California delivering Volkswagen parts, because I had only had 7 months experience as a nurse, and I had to, when I was applying for a job, I had to tell them, you know, nobody's going to hire me. I went on 100 job interviews, and they're all like, yeah, we'll call you, you know. And what I would do is I would take a nice set of clothes. I had my little Volkswagen outfit, you know, with a little circle that has your name in it. I had one of those with my name in it with a Volkswagen insignia. And I would load my truck up with Volkswagen parts, and I would set up a nursing interview for the end of the day. And I'd pop into a gas station bathroom and change my clothes from my little Volkswagen outfit into a nice outfit for an interview. And I'd go in and I'd interview, and people in the program just kept saying, just keep trying. Somebody's going to hire you. Just keep trying, keep trying, keep trying. And somebody hired me. I was shocked. It was an adolescent psych unit in Long Beach. And I had no experience as a psych nurse. I knew I was a troubled teen, so I could identify with those kids that were kind of in that situation. And I told the lady that interviewed me that I was in this program for nurses, and I'm in recovery now, and I'm clean, but I'll need you to fill out some paperwork and send it off to the Board of Nursing, because they had to fill out like a, you know, how am I doing on my job kind of deal. So she said, okay. And then I realized later that the reason I got that job is because no one else wanted that job. It was a horrible job. Like, the girl who I replaced had her femur fractured by the patients there. Yeah, they were violent, violent teenagers. Most of them coming out of juvenile hall, big. And the men I worked with were like giants, because they had to be to keep me safe from these very violent, some of them psychotic teenagers, which was really sad. But I was so grateful to have a job and to like be a nurse again and be able to like, you know, use my license and not having, you know, worked for 5 years to get a nursing license and then lost that all of a sudden. So I was very grateful, and they were very good to me. And then, you know, I lived this kind of miracle life that happened for me. I was married, and you know, as I'm making more money, our lifestyle is getting a little bit better and better, and my kids are doing great, and they're happy and healthy, and I decided with 3 or 4 years clean that I couldn't really afford a house in the nice neighborhood in Southern California. So we moved to Arizona, and I had, I think, 4 years clean. And I had to leave that sponsor because I knew I needed a face-to-face sponsor. I couldn't do the long-distance thing with only 4 years clean. That was not going to work for me. And she lived like two houses away from me, my sponsor did. And her little black Camaro would drive by my house, and I'd start bawling because she was like my lifeline. That girl was my lifeline. So we moved here, and, you know, I got another job, and then another job, and then another job, and then I fell into the career that I'd spent most of my life doing, and I was very good at. And I just did the whole NA thing. You know, I had a sponsor. I was sponsoring women. I was still working steps. In our sponsorship family, we worked 1 through 12 and start all over, 1 through 12, start all over, 1 through 12, start all over, and I've done many rounds of steps, many different ways. I've had 4 sponsors in 29 years, and my current sponsor I've had for 25 years. So you can see that in the beginning, I had a sponsor that relapsed, I had a sponsor that moved away, and then I moved away from that first one. And so the sponsor I have now just knows me probably better than anybody in my whole life, that we've done so many rounds of steps on so many different issues. And I do believe that the steps are the answer to most of my life problems. I won't say they're the answer to all of my life problems. And that's a little controversial. I've had to get some outside help for some issues that step work I did not believe was going to help me with. But that's an individual choice, and people can choose to do that or not. It's totally up to them. So I'm living this great life, and I'm seeing miracles left and right. I'm seeing, my home group is a women's meeting that I've belonged to for 25 years, and I've seen women come in that were like, oh, God, she's never staying clean. Wrong. She's got 15 years now. Just miracle after miracle after miracle. I was able to get a higher degree clean. I learned how to ride my own motorcycle clean. Like, I was so tired of being on the back, you know. I don't want to be on the back anymore. I want my own. That was scary. Let me tell you, they teach you on a little tiny Honda Rebel, which is like 500cc bike, right? Tiny little thing. And then you go home and you get on a real motorcycle, and it's like, oh, my God, I'm going to kill myself on this thing. But I learned, I was determined I was going to ride my own and not be subject to be on the back of somebody else's. And I got to do that for 10 years, you know, 10 years of riding my own motorcycle, which to some people sounds, you know, like not that big a deal. But for me, it was a big deal. You know, one of the stories I love to tell about miracles and recovery was I was sponsoring this girl, and she has given me permission to share this story, and I've shared it many, many times. We were at ARCNA one year, and on Sunday, after the Sunday morning speaker, we were sitting on the stage where the speaker had just spoken, and she said, "Eileen, I think I'm ready to find my daughter." And she had given this daughter up like 30-some years ago at a day old. You know, it was a one-night stand. The father was a Navajo, and she was living on the reservation because her mother was a teacher on the Navajo reservation. And so that threw a little twist into things. I said, okay, well, we'll get on the internet and figure out how to do that, because we have the internet now. It's way easier than it used to be trying to find a kid you gave up for adoption, you know. And the next day, no, that night, we went home Sunday night, and that night at like 3 o'clock in the morning, she called me hysterical, sobbing on the phone. And she said, "My daughter's in Tuba City, and she wants to meet me." Now, this is, I got goosebumps every time I tell that story, because she had just told me like 6 hours before that that she wanted to find her daughter, right, that she hadn't seen in 31 years or something. And that night, I guess her daughter had been looking for her, and somehow she ended up in Tuba, and she said, "I don't know what to do." I said, "We're going to go meet your daughter. That's what we're going to do." So I called in sick to work. I didn't call in sick. I said, "I have a family emergency," because I don't lie. I don't say I'm sick when I'm not sick, but I do call off of work. I'm calling off today. I don't say I'm calling in sick today when I'm not sick. I'm calling off today. That day I called in and said, "I have a family emergency, not coming into work today." And we drove to Tuba City, and we met her daughter. And I'll tell you what, it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. The tribe just welcomed this girl like she had been there her whole life. They had ceremonies and staging, and I was bawling my eyes out. And my sponsee was bawling her eyes out. And, you know, they still have a relationship today. That's probably 10 years ago now. And, you know, lots of little miracles. My kids grew up happy and healthy, and they know all about the disease of addiction. They went to meetings with me because I couldn't afford a babysitter, you know. They went to meetings with me, and they heard foul language, and I didn't care. I was going to break that cycle of denial and secrecy in my family. Nobody ever said the word alcoholism to my father until I did, until I was clean and I told him. You know, they would come visit me. They're from the East Coast, and they'd come visit me once a year, and they knew I was clean. And I had to call my dad. You know, I grew up in one of those families where you're to be seen and not heard. And you do what we say because we're the parents and you're not. That's the life I grew up in. And I had to call up my father with like 3 years clean or something and say, "You can't come to my house if you're going to drink." Like that, I felt like a three-year-old. I was so scared to say that to him. And his answer was, "Okay." And he stayed in a hotel and drank, you know. But at that point, I couldn't have that in my house. I couldn't be anywhere near. I couldn't go into a bar, a restaurant that had a bar right next to it, like in there. I couldn't go into a bar to use the bathroom. For years and years and years, it just, I could not have anywhere near me. So anyway, you know, I lived this idyllic life, this wonderful recovery awakening. You know, I found my higher power. I was sponsoring people. I felt like I was living the program. And then, and nothing bad ever happened to me. The whole, you know, 18 years I've been clean now. It's 2009, and the shit hit the fan. Let me tell you, it was a bad, bad year. My uncle died. One of my sponsees got cancer and died. Another girl I was sponsoring hung herself. And then December 11, 2009. Well, let me back up a month. November 11th, 2009, I filed for divorce because this husband that didn't like to work very much was now using. He was hooked on pain meds, and I'd done the begging thing, and you need to go to treatment. I'm not going to live like this. I had 18 years clean, but I was willing to wait for him. I was completely devoted. I will wait for you. I will. You go to treatment. You get a job. You keep a job for a year. You stay clean, and you can come back home. And he just couldn't or wouldn't. I'm not really sure which. So I moved out like 2 weeks after I filed, and then 2 weeks after that, he killed himself. And we had been married 20 years. And I, you know, I kind of had heard people going through tragedies and recovery, and like, and none of that had ever happened to me. I hadn't lost a child. I lost both my parents clean, but they were, you know, old and had sickness, and I was kind of prepared for that. You know, this was completely unexpected. So what ended up happening there was, you know, for the first time in my, I'm a very controlling person. I don't know if any of you can relate to that. I'm a very controlling person, and I'm a very organized person. And I worked in an ICU for many, many years, so things have to be just exactly right, or somebody's going to die, right? I worked with children. Some of them had 15 IVs going, dialysis, ventilator. I mean, you do not fuck that up, okay? Or somebody's going to die. So I carried that into my personal life, probably too much. And I was very rigid and structured and, you know, certain amount of meetings per week. I need to get this step done in a certain amount of time. I need to work on this character defect this month. I mean, it was very, very structured for me. It's just my personality. It keeps coming up on my defect list. 29 years later, I just finished the seventh step upstairs today. It's still there. But what happened was this tragedy happened, and I lost all control. And I didn't know what to do. I was like, you know, hysterical. First of all, I'm hysterical because my daughter, who's an adult and a nurse, calls me and says, "Dad's dead." And I, you know, I'm at work. I got an ICU patient, and I got absolutely hysterical. I had the doctors trying to console me. The charge nurse is trying to switch our assignments around so I can go home. It was horrible, horrible, horrible experience. And what happened in the next month was just, I can't talk about this without crying. Still, it's been 10 years. And they showed up. And they fed my kids. And they took me to meetings, which I did not want to go to. I felt like everybody thought this was my fault because I filed for divorce and then he killed himself. And I sat in the back of the meetings with my crying towel. I had a dish towel I carried with me because tissues were not going to cut it. So I had my crying towel, and I was just, I felt so weird and awkward, and like everybody was staring at me, and I wanted to get loaded so bad. I just wanted a sedative, you know. And I had women sleeping on the couch with me. Like, they wouldn't leave me alone. Like, this one girl spent weeks and weeks on sleeping on the couch with me at my daughter's house. And I finally had to tell her, "It's okay, go home. I need to be by myself for a day or two." And I, you know, I grieved. And I was so foggy. Like I'm such a rigid, organized person, and I would have a list. Like 2 weeks after this happened, I had things to do. I had to get a death certificate. I had to, you know, deal with a coroner, and I had to think about a service, and I was working. I had to talk to my job, my employer, and so I would make a list of like five things I need to try and do today, and I'd get one done, and then I have to go back home. I just could not function. I couldn't function. And I thought, my life is never going to be the same. I'm never going to be okay with this. And this is always going to be my fault. And I was wrong. You know, that was one of those times when step work wasn't going to cut it for me, that I had to get some outside help, and I had to find some people who had been through similar situations. Just like when I came here, I had to find people who understood me. Remember that therapist I told you about that had all those letters after her name that was an idiot? I didn't need her. I needed you. I needed people who were staying clean and knew how to, you know, deal with life on life's terms and deal with death and not get loaded. And, you know, NA showed up and carried me through that time. And after time, it took a long time. You know, I'm not going to say it was easy or quick. You know, I was over the sadness in like a year because I filed for, it took me 10 years to file for divorce, 10 years of thinking about it and going to my home group and crying and begging and wishing he would change, 10 years. And when I finally did it, I felt so free. And then he did that. And so, you know, about after, but I was ready to be divorced. You know, it took me a long time to make the decision. I was ready to be by myself. So about a year after that happened, I stopped crying and I got furious. I was so angry at him, not for doing that to me, because I was ready to be without him, just not like that, but for doing that to his kids. My son's the one that found him dead. And I thought, God, how could you do that to your children? And the anger took a lot longer to go away, probably 3 or 4 years. But I remembered, you know, it's so simple sometimes. I just forget. All I had to do is ask my higher power to relieve me of that anger. And within a week, it was gone. It was gone, like completely. I was filled with rage and anger for years. And when I just remembered to ask God for help, like, gone. It was gone. So, you know, that was 10 years ago, and my life has gotten amazing again. You know, I'm remarried, and I have 13 grandkids. Holy shit, am I busy. Wow. I knew I was going to love being a grandma, but oh my God, they just keep procreating. Holy shit. So Bill and I, we babysit every week, and you know, I live a miracle life again. I'm retired. I had a kind of an unexpected retirement. I had back surgery 3.5 years ago, T2 to L3. So I have 27 screws and 2 rods in my back. And I thought I was going to go back to work after that, and that did not happen. So I had to do the whole disability lawyer bullshit, go to court. And I've been on disability for three and a half years now. Which is a blessing because now I can babysit my grandkids and their essential worker parents can go to work, you know. In the last couple of years, I've learned about boundaries with my children because free childcare is enticing and attractive to them. And they know I'm a pediatric ICU nurse. Like, who's safer to be with than someone that loves them that's a pediatric ICU nurse? But that I can only take so much. You know, there are days when Bill's a little bit older than me, and he's got some physical limitations too. And there are days we have 5 kids, you know, 3 toddlers, a couple school age, and then COVID hit, and now we're homeschooling. Oh, yay. Joy and happiness there. Let me tell you, not. And I am not happy about our numbers right now because I know it's coming. We're going back to the computer shit at my house. Anyway, I have no control over that. I learned a good lesson about being, you know, my controlling behavior when it came to computer learning with my grandchildren, because I wanted everything to be perfect. And I am not a teacher. I'm a nurse. And if you are really loud and in pain, I will sedate your ass and you'll go to sleep. And you cannot do that to your grandchildren. So I learned a lot about patience and learning and doing the best I can. You know, now today, the best I can is good enough. And 10 years ago, that would not have been good enough. I would have been going to school to learn how to be a good teacher so that my grandkids would be like up there, you know. And today, good enough is good enough. We go on science field trips. I'm an avid birder, okay? That sounds crazy and weird. I have a camera with a lens that's that long. And I had to find a passion after I lost my career. You know, that was a huge part of my identity. So I become an avid birder. I have a life list, and I go search. I go on vacations just looking for certain birds. It's crazy. But you should see the pictures I take. If you're friends with me on Facebook, you see my pictures. They're amazing. But I'm waiting for one of my grandkids to, like, spark, have that interest. Oh, I want to go with you. And one of my six-year-old grandkids said she's ready, but I don't think she's really ready. She's very hyper. You have to be very quiet when you're birding. But, you know, sometimes we take if I'm fed up with the computer, we go on a science day. We're going on a field trip. We'll go out to Hacienda River Preserve, and I'll make a list for them, find a bug that's green, find a bird that's yellow, you know, just whatever. And we have a science day because I can't do the computer one more day. It's driving me crazy, and it's making them crazy. So So, you know, back to recovery. And that to me is recovery. Okay, I've learned to use spiritual principles in all of my affairs. Right? I have learned that the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous are not for me to learn how to deal with you in here. You teach me how to live my life out there and how to, like, interact with people in an appropriate manner and not say fuck you when I want to say fuck you and not call up one of the teachers who I think is a terrible teacher and tell her what I think. You know, I have learned I'm a, you know, productive member of society. I have a beautiful home. I live on a lake, so there's birds always in my backyard. My kids trust and love me. My husband has 6 children. I have 2. So we have this huge blended family. And I think his kids, if we were to ever break up, his kids would pick me. I think they would. But we have this great connection, and we have a family dinner once a month, and all the cousins get to play with each other at our house. And I'll tell you, my home group is still my home group. I have times when I love my home group and times when I don't love my home group that much. But I always go back to the women, always. They're my rock. They're my teachers. You know, I have the most time in my home group, which is a little difficult sometimes. But I do go to other meetings that have people with more time than me. I need to take sometimes. You know, I can't always be the giver. I still sponsor women. Like I said, I just finished the 7th step, and I'm completely dedicated to, you know, continuing this journey for the rest of my life. And I'm going to read my favorite paragraph to you from It Works How and Why.
Yeah.
I got to put my glasses on. I can't see anything without glasses anymore. And this is how I'm going to end today. This is from the end of step 11 in It Works How and Why. we see that regardless of the presence or absence of material success in our lives, we can be content. We can be happy and fulfilled with or without money, with or without a partner, with or without the approval of others. We've begun to see that God's will for us is the ability to live with dignity, to love ourselves and others, to laugh, and to find great joy and beauty in our surroundings. Our most heartfelt longings and dreams for our lives are coming true. These priceless gifts are no longer beyond our reach. They are, in fact, the very essence of God's will for us. In our gratitude, we go beyond merely asking for the power to live up to God's plan for our own lives. We begin to seek out ways to be of service, to make a difference in the life of another addict, to carry the message of recovery. Our spiritual awakening has opened us up to spiritual contentment, unconditional love, and personal freedom. Knowing that we can only keep this precious gift by sharing it with others, we go on to step 12. So that's my message to you. Thank you for letting me share. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Eileen. Mallory, addict.
Mallory.
I have asked Melissa to